Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Yeah, so sorry we missed the stream last week, obviously. I think it was just, we were too busy, I think, in the convention. It was a great con, right?
Totally. Oh, yeah. I enjoyed it so much. I mean, it's always the highlight of my year. So it was really great seeing people. Let me really tired. I've been recovering all week. Much action.
Yeah. So we could talk a little bit about the convention, I think. And then, but like, I'd really like to focus in on my run of our first Dungeon Design Dash content, which I finally got to run for people. So I think that's going to be really interesting to talk about.
Well, I really want to hear about it myself, actually, because since I didn't get to sit in on it because I collapsed that night, I personally am like really curious how that went.
Great. Oh, we're live. Let's go. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about our D&D HouseCon, which is now in its 15th year. This is where we get together with our friends every spring for a weekend of all gaming. And we'll be going through what lessons did we learn that can improve all of our us and your games in the future. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into that, I'll remind everyone, as always, that at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. You can join in on that, if you like, by being a patron of the site. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, you'll get an invite to our private Discord server, where at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our live video chat with Dan and I and any patrons who happen to be around. So come join us.
Yeah, we would love for you to join us. If you're new or if you're revisiting, please be a patron of Wandering DMs. Yeah. So I've been looking forward to this chat, and I personally... missed us being on last weekend, of course, but we were very busy with our annual house kind of a little bit earlier in the year than we normally do it, Paul.
Yeah, slightly earlier, because I usually try to avoid the conflict with, guess what, today, happy Easter, Dan.
Right. I think I had a family member going, what are you doing for Easter? You have an Easter dinner? I'm like, I don't track the holidays so well, Mom. So no.
Yeah. But for folks coming out to a weekend long convention, I try to avoid the conflict with Easter. So we did a little early this year. It was good.
Which was great. Yeah, it was.
It was good. It's always a crapshoot of what kind of weather we're going to see at this, because we rent a house out on the Cape. Because it's, beach summer house, and this is a terrible time of year to rent such a house. It's a great time if you're going to play board games and role-playing games all weekend and just stay in the house all weekend. Because we really don't know what kind of weather we're going to get. Some years it's been absolutely freezing cold and sleeting, and some years it's glorious and sunny, and we take a walk on the beach while we're there. I don't know about you, Dan, but I did not make it out to the beach this time.
Well, I have photographic proof that I did do that, Paul. You could pull up a featured image. Yeah. Yes. So really beautiful bit of shoreline right down by where we play. And there's kind of an interesting big cliff. That's actually not the house where we're in, but somewhere around there. There's a really interesting big cliff right there down to the sea that kind of spawns me ideas about actually encounter areas or possible things, because it's actually a little perilous to get down there. But I actually did do that I kind of committed to every morning getting out and getting a little air.
Nice.
So
nice.
Well, I love the shore.
Yeah, it was pretty rainy. It was a little cold, a little rainy this year. And for those who don't know, of course, I'm still recovering from a broken ankle, so I'm hobbling around in a boot. So I did not, unfortunately, make it out onto the sand this year, but had a great time nonetheless. I mean, it always flies by every year, and ran some games, played some games, saw some old friends. It's a good time.
It really was. Before you get off the shot of the beach, I will say one morning I was out there and some local woman with her two dogs. Just me, and then coming the other way, there was a local woman with two dogs. I'm walking in this direction, the shot actually. And as she comes, she says, the tide's coming in really fast. That beach is going to be gone in 10 minutes, is what she says. I'm like, oh, okay. A little, Well, I have a little 2 in 6 chance of getting trapped on the beach. That's good to know. Oh, thank you.
I mean, you know, between that and like the cliff, like it's fascinating, I think, when we're out in the world like that and you just start hitting, especially when your brain is in kind of a role-playing game space, and you immediately start thinking about like, well, I've never seen an adventure that included an encounter area where like the position of the tide matters. That'd be interesting. I want to do that. I want,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, I would like a dungeon where that's maybe in a, you know, open cave, and you know, the tide suddenly comes in quickly or something. That sounds cool.
This is the thing that's good to wander the world in. You do a little bit of wandering and you pick up these things that you wouldn't just sitting in your own house. I'll also say that, so William in the chat is saying, well, that just gives off all kinds of Lovecraftian vibes. And if I can do a little bit of a sidetrack here just for a second. So this is in Massachusetts. And some number of years ago, I happened to get a job. I was just out of college. I happened to get a job working on the filming of The Crucible, feature film that was filmed in the 90s. And it was shot on an island off the coast of Massachusetts. And I got, among other things, I got a job of being the overnight animal caretaker on the set. So they had a whole bunch of livestock, horses, oxen, pigs, all kinds of stuff like that. And I was the one person tapped to be the overnight caretaker before the actual shoot started. So I bike in, elaborate set, everybody takes off for the day, no power. I'm actually camping out in the horse pen in a sleeping bag. And as the light fades, I decide to bring my Lovecraft, and I'm reading The Shadow Over Innsmouth. And I'm like, yeah, horrible fish people on the shore, Innsmouth. And I'm like, I'm on an abandoned island a couple miles off of Ipswich, Massachusetts. I'm actually in the place where Shadow Over Innsmouth was inspired. And then the sun goes down. I'm like, oh Lord. And I'm amazing. All alone on an abandoned island.
It's funny you bring that up, because at our house con this year, we actually featured two separate horror games, both running my system Fearful Ends, one run by me, one run by Max, former player of 10 Dead Rats, both around sort of nautical themes. And one of the funny jokes was that in both cases, the NOAA came up in both games, which is the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, if I'm getting that right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. I think so.
And it was just amusing. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. My game included a scene on a ship of an NOAAS. Albatross was the name of the ship. I think in Max's game, we were on a fishing boat. We were all on a fishing boat, and one of the characters was an employee of the NOAA, was there to monitor turtle release some mechanism in the fishing nets that allows turtles to escape. That's
wow. I didn't know that was the thing.
Yeah. There you
great.
Go.
See, you learn so many things that I learned from gaming. That's great.
Yeah. So funny. That would all come up, and perfect setting for it. I adore when horror games are run close to the actual setting of where they're set. It's hilarious.
I agree. Yeah. It's pretty killer. It was raining Saturday, and the covered porch starts leaking where we run some of our games. And I've done this in the past. One of our fellow DMs was like, I want to set my game in the leaky porch, because it's got an aquatic nautical theme. Please put me in the leaky porch with my players. Like, yeah. You got it, sir.
Yeah. I thought that was going to be, you know, we have like four or five gaming, or three or four gaming spaces. I guess four like really ideal gaming spaces in that house. And there's at the beginning of each time period when games are running side by side, there's a little powwow between the GMs about who gets what space. And I really thought, I thought nobody was going to want that porch this year because of the leak. And you know, it's very funny that one of the GMs was like, that's for me. Put me in there.
Would embrace like the chaos.
Yeah.
Good work. Good work on that. Yeah. So, what were the highlights for you last weekend, Paul?
Well, enjoy both running and playing Fearful Ends. Always happy to do that. Enjoy running it, and I'm trying to get to the point here where I can run. I'm gonna in the upcoming conventions. I'm gonna try and run it more, raise a little more awareness, sell off some of these extra copies I've got lying around. If any of our viewers want to check it out, that's at fearfulends.com. This is a fun game, and of course, love getting to be a player in that game. That's a rare treat for me to get somebody else to run it, and I get to sit down and just be a player. So that's super fun. It's funny. This is the 15th year that we've run this convention. Not consecutive year. We missed a year or two there due to the pandemic. But we've run it for 15 years, and this is the first year as the administrator of this event that I had to deal with a GM was unable to make it last minute. And I can't believe, like, right. I'm shocked, frankly, to look back at this and go, how has this never happened? But yeah, the good news was it was a fiasco game that I was scheduled to play in. Fiasco requires very little of the person running it, so. In fact, as written, there is not supposed to be a GM. You're just supposed to run it collaboratively as a GM-less game. So that's exactly what we did.
Great. Okay, great. So
that went off without a hitch. But the big one that I really want to talk about, of course, is I ran a single session of OD&D using WDM01, the Asymmetric Monastery of the Deranged Berserkers. Which is the first ever design dash featured here on Wandering DMs in season 3. I think it was episode 34, if I recall correctly. We designed that entire dungeon in 1 hour on the show. And that's the first time I just sat down and ran it straight. And it's been a while, frankly, I've been so focused on Fearful Ends for so long, it's been a while, honestly, since I ran some OD&D. So it was nice to get back to OD&D, and it was super fun to run the design dash. So I thought, Dan, maybe you and I could go over that and talk a little bit about what happened. I could, because you weren't even in the game. I don't think we ever chatted about the game. So as far as I know, you know nothing about it. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That is correct. I think I got a little taste of just what happened with one of the magic items. I guess I just asked, like, how many intelligent swords were there? And I got a number back.
Yeah.
And that's actually all I know about how that played. So, yeah, I'm actually very curious about how that ran. I will say again, I kind of wanted to sit in at least just as an observer, if not anything else. And then since that was Saturday night, I ran two games straight Saturday morning through afternoon. So it was like 8 hours of DMing for me. And that's, that's normally fine, but man, I was wrecked. I was like surprisingly wrecked Saturday night. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go take a nap. About 8, I should be down about 9. I'll join in. And that didn't happen.
Yeah,
that didn't happen.
And I will say, it's one of, save on this one.
Right. I did. And I think that actually constitutes, Since everybody knows that I'm kind of a late owl, normally at our house con, I'm the one that literally turn out the lights every night. So normally there's like a late night conversation with somebody and sort of I'm part of that all the time. And then I go around, do a last cleanup and then turn out the lights. And I actually think this Saturday night might have been the first night in 15 years that I didn't turn the lights out at the end of the night, actually. Because I was comatose.
Fascinating. Does that throw you? Did it throw you for the remainder of the coach? Saturday night.
It threw me. It threw other people. Actually, they were like, "Where's how do we? What do we do? Where's Dan? What happened?" There was some consternation actually about whether I was okay or not. As a matter of fact, and I was perfectly fine. Was happy as a clam, literally. But I missed observing the design dash run through. So I'm wildly curious what happened.
Yeah, let me catch up for viewers who aren't aware, though I imagine you all are. I'll just very quickly mention, we've done this now 4 times on the show where we spend the entire show, we just take a small map, and Dan and I interactively very quickly try to flesh out an entire adventure in 1 hour. And it's very fun. We use a lot of Matt Finch's tools. The title is kind of randomly generated. So that's how you end up with these lovely titles like Asymmetric Monastery of the Deranged Berserkers. And then after the show, we do an edit pass, we clean it up, and we release it as a PDF available to our viewers. Free for our patrons, and then available for purchase, I think, for $1 over on DriveThruRPG. So you can get this right now if you don't already have it. You can go grab this on DriveThruRPG. And it's very short, right? It's just two pages of content there. And I thought it would fit very well for a 4-hour convention game, and I thought, let's find out. Let's give it a whirl. This one was written for 4 to 6 players, levels 3 to 6. So I have a kind of a standard batch of OD&D characters that I use consistently for all my OD&D convention games. I actually had to down-level them at this one, and I definitely debated should the intelligent swords be present or not at this low level. At what level, Dan, is it reasonable for a character to find an intelligent sword, do you think?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm a big fan of random tables, so I would support potentially literally any level. I'd say probably, at least second, and I'd say likelihood, like around 8, actually, I guess, if you were being completely robotic about it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so we were playing levels 3 to 6. I think I gave them, let's see if I'm remembering correctly, I think I gave them 12,000 experience points, which meant that your pure thieves were hitting level 5, and your pure magic users were at level 4. I think maybe the fighters were at level 4 as well, which gave them a feat, which was nice.
Yes.
Your multi-class characters generally came in around level 3.
I was running another adventure Saturday afternoon, and those are exactly the same levels that I pegged it at myself.
Yeah. It's an interesting spot in the level curve, I find, because your magic users haven't hit level 5 yet, so you don't have fireballs and lightning bolts. But you have some magic items, and your fighters are starting to have a feat and a good amount of hit points. So, it's starting to get interesting, I think, at this point. It's not the sweet spot yet for me. It's not the level that I'm like, yes, this is where D&D just absolutely shines, but it's getting there. So it was fun. And it was interesting to kind of, like I said, to take the characters and down level them, get them to that, what do these characters look like when they were at 12,000 experience points? And I have one magic user who's got who tends to just have a lot of scrolls on him. So I gave him a couple scrolls of spells that are just out of reach. So there was a scroll of fireball available, right?
Okay.
Right. So they could have gotten a one off, right? And then there's a second pure magic user who is much more of a utility mage who happens to have a broom of flying, and I decided to let him keep that for this level because that's fun. So there was some interesting magic items going on here. You have a broom of flying. You have two characters with magic swords with intelligent swords. We had a total, I think, of 6 players in this game. So, right there in the middle. It was a good group.
Neat.
And then I'll just let me push forward here on the images. Let me show. I guess here's the first page. This is the first page of the content, which shows the map, the wandering monster key, a little background, some notes, etc. And actually, I'm going to zoom in on the map. So here's the map that we populated, and the basic gist of this is that you've got some berserkers, essentially, some wild raiding nomads who are coming through, and they've stopped along the river for who knows what reason. You as DM know, of course, that their goal is to visit the strange extra-dimensional creature that lives in, I think, room 12 here, the upper right corner. There's a strange extra-dimensional creature who's giving off a gas, and that gas effectively has a combination of effects of a potion of heroism, granting you 4 fighter levels, which at level 4 is pretty significant, right?
Right.
Doubling your abilities. So potion of heroism and a confusion spell. So you're getting super strong, buffed up, lots of hit points, extra bonus to hit. And every round, you have to roll to see whether you attack your friends or attack the enemies or stand there drooling as you come under the effects of this gas. So the berserkers, according to the according to the text, are coming in along the river. So it's an underground river. They're coming in from the top of the map along the north. They're riding in the river in their boats, landing around Area 11. There's other little spots that where they've maybe landed. There's a couple having lunch there at Area 2. There's evidence that they've been through Area 9. But they're congregating at Area 11 to go fill their homemade bladders full of this gas to use in their attacks.
Great.
And then the setting here, right? This is the monastery. So it's an old monastery, an old abandoned monastery, this underground. So what I described it as is there is this old monastery, or the ruins of a monastery at the top of a hill. And it's really just rubble. There's really just nothing left up there at the top. But along the side of the hill, the river cuts along the base of the hill, and this group of nomads has camped out there, and everybody's worried that they're going to attack the village. That was the setup I gave my players, because I wanted to allow them possible multiple entries to this dungeon. I actually ran them through the approach, where I said, you've been hired by this village to go deal with this issue, right? It's a huge camp. So they come up the river, they see the hill, they see the ruins at the top, they see the camp of nomads along the side, which has hundreds. I described it as hundreds of nomads camped out, right? Way too big a force for them to deal with. And then I also gave them this info of, like, but strangely, you see a small group of them pick up some boats and walk into a cave rather than down to the river, right? My assumption being that inside the cave, there's maybe a spring that feeds this underground river that then goes and feeds back into the main river or something.
Great. Great.
So I'm kind of inventing this little area in my head that is north of this map that is, you know, a cave with an underground spring, maybe with a little lake in it where they're putting in their boats to come in and get down here.
Great.
And so I was kind of curious to see if my players going to try and sneak into the cave and come in via the river route? Are they going to go up to the top and discover the entrance into the ruins and come the main way? What do you think? What's your instinct? What do you think players would do, Dan? Or what would you do if you were a player?
This I think I overheard a little bit of post-game analysis from some of the players, actually, about when they were debating about what to do here. And I'm not sure I did hear exactly what the ultimate outcome was. I feel like probably if they saw the nomads go in the cave, it's likely that they would follow suit.
In our case, what happened was they decided to climb to the top of the hill. They decided to swing around the backside of the hill and then climb to the top so that they would have the advantage of height and they could spy on the camp and see what was going on. Now, while up there, someone discovered the entrance into the monastery, and they decided to go check it out. And so they ended up actually coming down the stairs on the left side.
And that's why you play, because that surprises me a bit. Good play on that part.
I wanted to give them that optionality of coming in either direction, because I think that's interesting. I think that's fun. Right? Yeah. See which way they came. Now, interestingly, they came in, and I'm just looking at the map here. I think even with just 12 rooms, even with 12 areas, that's too much. That's too much for a 4-hour convention game. My players very smartly managed to avoid the excess. They came in, they avoided the door to room 1. They were like, nope, not interested. They went into area 2, where they encounter a small group of berserkers camped out by the river. They fight them. They're very curious about this interesting river and this evidence that they've been traveling there. They totally ignore the door to the north. They look at it. They're like, don't like it. I think we describe it as having somebody has scraped into it a skull and crossbones.
Right.
And so they're like, the nomads don't like this area. Our goal is to talk to the nomads. We can therefore ignore this area.
Great.
They walk through the south. There's some interesting stuff there in room 6 and 7, which they kind of looked at and went, this is weird. We don't know what to do with this, and ignored it. They proceeded to then find the hallway from 7 back to the river, and they went, okay, the river is the exciting part, and they've tried to figure out how to get from the river across to the opening into room 9, and then from there proceeded up to 10 and 11 and finally to 12. The fun bit here is, now here's an area where a case where you and I run very differently, Dan. I know that when you're running the game, I'm going to jump back to the first page here. I know when you're running the game that you have a very strict way of checking for wandering monsters. I tend to usually forget about the wandering monster chart. I ignore it until such time where I go, the game's starting to drag a little. I feel like it could use some action. And that's where I was when they were coming through that hallway towards the river. I'm like, okay, we had one fight, but like, we've been here for a couple hours. We've had exactly one fight. Something interesting should happen. And I just looked at the wandering monster chart. I did not roll on it because I said, you know what would be the most exciting thing here is as they're trying to use their broom of flying to ferry people across from 7 to 9, if a boat came down the river full of berserkers.
And, oh, great. Okay.
And then even more interestingly, I decided to interpret that. I'm going to zoom back in on the map here. I decided to because they trounced the first group of berserkers. Let me put it that way. In room 2, there's maybe 4 of them sitting around a campfire. My group of 6 level 4 characters just absolutely trounced these berserkers. It was no effort for them whatsoever. So this time I put 4 more in the boat, and I decided one of them in the boat. Actually, no, I'm sorry, I'm wrong. There was only 3. I pictured it like a canoe. So there's one in front, one in back, and one standing in the middle, kind of directing. And I decided the one in the middle actually had a bladder full of the gas. And so as they get into combat, he huffs it, right? And so now you've got 2 kind of level 1 berserkers, and you've got one who's got 4 extra levels of fighter, right? Now we're getting someplace. And let me tell you, for me, this was the most fun encounter of the whole game. Because it's weird, right? Like, you've got this interesting terrain where they're dealing with this river. I've got one character who's got a broom of flying, and I've got another character who's got a helm of underwater action. So I've got a player in the water. I've got a player flying. They've got players stuck on either side of the landings. I've got these guys in a boat. I kind of made... I'd actually drawn out the battle area because one of my players brought a battle mat. It's usually not, I usually don't deal with miniatures, but one of my players had it ready to go, and I'm like, sure, let's do it.
Same story.
And I was
for
very
me.
Glad to have
Same
it.
Same story for me this weekend. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So I was super glad to have it. So I took some paper and I folded it into the little shape of a boat, and I kind of brought my figures. And as they attack, it's just delightful because I'm just emulating physics here. I'm like dragging the little boat. And I go, okay, and they are attacking the guy in the back, and so they have no more propulsion, and so they're just at the the boat is just moving based on the current of the river, and I twist the boat, and right in that little, if you can see it, right between 7 and 9, the river chokes in a little bit. Sure enough, the boat spins and just gets stuck. And so now the boat is jammed in place. And the berserker who's huffed his gas decides to just dive at one of the, just tackle somebody into the river. Right. And such a, you could just imagine this, right? Like it's just so good. It was just such a good encounter because there's so many interesting things happening with the terrain and the players and the threats, and it just all felt very natural and easy. It was my favorite encounter of the game.
Great. Oh man, that's so good. That's great. I love the improvised boat miniature.
Right, I just took like an index card, and I kind of folded it up into the shape of a canoe that would fit some miniatures. Yeah, it worked really well. That was super fun. I loved that the players had some magic to deal with the terrain, but not enough. Right, that you've got a player on a broom who can take one passenger, and you've got one player who's got an underwater, helm of underwater action, so they can just go walk along the base of the river, no problems. And then you've got, that leaves 3 of the players stuck with, what do I do? Do I risk it? Do I jump for the boat? Do I, right? Like, so lots of stuff like that. That was really fun.
That's very good. Yeah, that's very good. Super neat.
That was great. I think, again, I'm sure, I'm predicting here, Dan, that you hate my method of generating wandering monsters for this.
I don't, you're right that I don't do the same thing. How can you possibly hate that? So good on you. Obviously the right call. You're right that's not the way that I would do it. I can talk about what I did in my game that was happening earlier that day.
Remind me what if you were running this game, let me put it that way. If you were running this game, what is your process for dealing with wandering monsters? Just to remind me and the viewers.
I have a watch on the table, and for me now it's every 15 minutes. If I'm looking at the watch, I roll a D6 to see if a 1 comes up for wandering monster, and if the players do something that obviously takes more time. So they're searching for secret doors comprehensively, wandering monster check. They are having to bash down a door and making a lot of noise, wandering monster check. So if they're doing something that's obviously generally like a search type thing that's taking a lot of time, there's a wandering monster chip, and I am very explicit about it. I tell them in advance, there's going to be a wandering monster chip. If you do this, I'm going to roll this die. On a one, something shows up. And so I kind of put it forward to them as a resource that they have to conscientiously decide on. So they know what the risk rewards are about that.
And I like that. Honestly, I like the idea of it adding time pressure, right? That is, in my mind, that's my favorite part of your method. Is like, it's very clear to the players, oh geez. Now my problem is that I get into the details of running and I'm focused on what's happening, and I would just, even with the watch on the table, I feel like I would probably miss it and I'd forget. And then generally, yeah, I'm, you know, it's very arbitrary that I decided, okay, the players, you know, I feel like the pacing of the game at this point could use a combat, so I'm just going to force it. Though I'm sure if you were running it, if you were in the same situation I was, you probably would decide that, yes, their efforts at ferrying people across the river probably warrants a wandering monster check.
Right? Yes, so and I would roll it. Yeah, and I would roll it exactly at the most awkward moment for the players possible. So when they're exposed or halfway across, that's exactly when I would check. Or I think in my game, one person rappelled down a narrow chimney, and when they were alone, wandering monster check, right? Or when they're split up, that's when I check. So it's exactly the same moment that I would check at it. And I you're certainly indubitably correct on that tense moment.
Yeah, yeah, that's fun. I like the added tension there. Yeah. So for me, I like, and you know, my players spent time debating and analyzing, right? So they spent time thinking about opening the door to one. They spent time thinking about opening the other door to the northern area. Should we do this? Should we not? Which door is more interesting? They walk through areas 6 and 7, which has an interesting kind of trick magic thing going on. They looked at it, they thought about it, but then they kind of noped out, right? So I was starting to have this experience of this, okay, this group is very careful, right? This group, for whatever reason, they're being very careful. They're not quite turtling, but they're close to it, right?
Yeah.
They're not a just bang down the door and come and, you know, guns blazing kind of group. So I thought they could use a little more push. And then looking at the wandering monster chart, there's some good stuff on here.
Can I interrupt and just ask, so can I conclude that Max was not a player in this game?
You are correct. Max was not in this game.
Because somebody would have tripped all that stuff. If he'd been playing. Great. Sorry to interrupt her.
Wait, is that true? Wait. I'm looking at the player list and I'm trying to remember. So the interesting thing was I had 8 players signed up for this, and the 2 people who called in sick last minute were both in my game. So that's why I was only down to 6.
Got it.
And no, Max was there. I'm looking at the player list and Max was there, so I'm trying to remember which character he was playing. Why didn't Max kick in the door? Fascinating.
You know, he's trying a new hat. He's trying, you know, good, you know, he's a man of many characters, and I respect that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Max had one of the intelligent swords. Right, so he was playing the thief who has... So I have 2 intelligent swords who have... I enjoy role-playing as. They have very distinct personalities. I have a halfling fighter who has an intelligent sword named Pip. And Pip is very accommodating and very helpful. And he's kind of has an English accent. And he's always... he's almost like the character's butler. You know, whatever you need, sir. Cheerio, right? And one of the things... One of his special abilities is he can detect gold. So he's very excited about helping his master find, you know, treasure. But I've also decided he's a coward. And Pip does not like combat. And this is interesting to me. And I set this up because, you know, with intelligent swords, there's always the chance that the intelligent sword takes over, right? And so it's fun to have a character who's playing a fighter who's all about go, 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 get him. And then the intelligent sword chimes in and goes, this is too scary. Let's run away, right? Right, makes the opposite choice. Hilarious to me. That's not the character Max was playing. Max was playing the thief, so a thief who had a sword who was named Aisha the Vexing. Now Aisha has the ability to detect traps, and she's very angry about it. And she really wants her owner to die a horrible death. And so she's very abusive, and she's often very annoyed when asked if there are traps. And so she'll respond with things like, darn it, no, there's no exciting, deadly, you know, methods of your imminent demise anywhere near us. Darn it. Right? Or, yes.
Why have I not known about this?
There's a deadly trap through this door. I recommend you blindly walk through it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, so as an aside to the viewer, right, if I hadn't been entirely wiped out that night, Paul and I had discussed an idea where I'd step in the room, observe, and then play the intelligent swords. And now I'm really sad I didn't get to play Aisha the Vexing. That's a great piece of business.
Aisha the Vexing is super fun. And so that's great. The character Max was playing. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why he didn't. You'll have to ask him why he wasn't more aggressive about jumping through stuff. So, like, the other interesting thing going on here in the area is Area 9, I think it's labeled as.
Yeah.
No, 8. Sorry, Area 8 is a little beach along the river. And there are some bombardier of beetles around there. And so there's a lot of mention of, like, an oily residue on top of the water there, left behind by the bombardier of beetles. And the party was very curious about this, but not curious enough to actually go and explore it. They thought it was important. They weren't sure what the heck it was, but they again opted for safety and didn't go anywhere near that area. So when I was looking at the wandering monster chart, I was like, okay, well, they've avoided the giant lizard. They didn't go into the area where there's a giant lizard. They didn't go into the area where there's bombardier beetles. And these are things that are on the wandering monster chart as well. And I thought for consistency's sake, the most fun thing here is more berserkers. That's number 2 on our wandering monster chart. So that's what I went with.
Yep. So and I think that winds up giving you three beats of berserkers in the session, which is really narratively great.
Yep. Agreed. Yep. Agreed. And then by the time you get to 11, there's a big camp of them. You know, I actually did. I ramped down the number of them at this point. So that's the other thing I decided on the fly. If you go by the text, it says there are 20 berserkers at Area 11. Now, these are all one-hit die berserkers. I think actually that would be an exciting fight for our group. But it was just a pacing thing at this point where I was like, they're going to win. I have no doubt that my players are going to win. And this is just going to be a slog for them to just whittle down 20 berserkers. And so I dropped it to a dozen.
Were you, I'll ask here, because I think that like I came around to committing to the following after we wrote this adventure, I think. Were you honoring the sweep attack rule that original AD&D uses, where if your fourth level fighters are making 4 attacks a round against one hit die types?
No, I was not, honestly, and just simply because I completely forgot about it. You know.
Yeah. It's a little awkward rule. I went back and forth about it, but you've played a lot of BX, and they removed that rule from that system, so. I'm not surprised that it's not immediately on your DNA.
I mean, now here's the funny thing. With this group, they clearly needed a little encouragement to push on, like repeatedly, right? I was kind of pushing harder on from the GM side of like adding of ramping up the pacing. And maybe it would have helped if I had been rolling the wandering monster die. Maybe that would have added some tension just because of time. I don't know. I don't know what was exactly going on. But here's the funny thing. We get towards the end, and we're like, there's like 10 minutes of game time left. And this is late at night. This is late at night. I think we were playing Saturday night. So it's running until midnight. And so it's about 10 minutes to midnight. One of them, they managed to kill all the berserkers in Area 11. One of them goes rushing up into Area 12, happens to be our halfling fighter with the intelligent sword Pip. Sees the horrific extraplanar creature and decides, I'm going to attack it. And he rushes in there, sword swinging. And he's fully now under the effects of the gas. So he's like, woohoo, this is great, you know, and I have to roll it. He's, you know, annoyed that he's got to roll this d6 every round to see what he does. And the other players, some of the other players are dealing with the fact that the berserkers in Area 11 had some prisoners. And so they're like, you know, high-fiving each other, like, hey, mission accomplished, we rescued some prisoners. That's right, because they were presented with, like, go see what the what these nomads are up to and if they're a threat, and, like, you know, if you can do anything to help avoid them attacking the village, please do so, right? And so they're like, well, you know, we think there's so many berserkers here, we think, and they're clearly not interested in talking to us, there's no way we're gonna prevent an attack on the village apart from maybe, you know, whittling away at them in small groups or finding a leader and eliminating the leader. But when by the time they find prisoners, they're like, yes, result, right? We did something, right? We helped in some way. We rescued some prisoners. So they're, you know, using their last 10 minutes to ferry some of the prisoners out of there, which I'm like, great, great. Rescued some prisoners. Feel good moment. Could be a conclusion to the game. The party basically completely splits at this point. Three of the players decide it is great fun to rush into the room and hack away at the giant extra player ooze. And three of the players are like, no, no thanks. And here's, weirdly, Max is in the no thanks group. I'm pretty sure Max decides, nope, I'm going to help get the prisoners out here. Maybe he was just sleepy. But he decided, nope, I'm going to help get these creatures out of here. And then I've got three other players who just rush in, sword swinging. And holy cow, let me just read the stats to you that we wrote for the extra planar ooze, because, wow, right? We thought this was a good idea, Dan, for level 4 to 6. This is, or 3 to 6.
You're welcome.
This is shocking. The extra planar ooze is AC6, 16 hit dice. 16 hit dice. One attack at 3d6 damage. Right? Special resistance, half damage from blunt weapons. And is emitting this gas that, as we mentioned, you save versus spells or gain 4 fighter levels and act randomly based on a d6 roll. All three of them succumb to the gas and just start. It's just a bloodbath in the room. They're hacking away at the ooze. They're sometimes beating on each other. They manage to get the ooze kills 2 of them. They manage to get the ooze down to 4 hit points before it finally kills the last one of them.
Yes, someone was telling me that later. So Paul, I would say that was pretty well balanced, and I'm gonna pat us, the Wandering DMs, back for very carefully balancing an encounter that was almost exactly their strength level. And if they'd had the whole team come in, they probably would have won.
I'm frankly shocked by this. Yeah, if they had the whole team come in, they probably would have won. And I'm just surprised, because I'm looking at those stats and I'm thinking, if I was a player in this, I would be in the group that would go, no, we're done here, nothing to be gained, let's get the hell out.
Yeah,
right. Especially because it's here in the room. Like, if you had more game time to deal with it, maybe there's an argument for, like, okay, I don't think this thing's going anywhere. Let's back out. Let's recoup. Let's do and then we can do a careful, coordinated attack on it. Although I guess you have the counterpoint. Couple hundred berserkers on the hillside, who knows when more of them are going to show up.
True.
Right. But it was surprisingly well balanced. I was very pleased with the outcome. And I think if they had just been a little luckier on some of the confusion rolls, or if they had one more character, in there helping out, they would have been okay. If one of them had made their save, maybe that would have been something.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Paul, if you're looking for refined, thoughtful, well-balanced, old-school D&D adventures, Paul, Wandering DMs is your source.
It's really surprising. I gotta say, 16 hit dice with 3d6 damage is rough. That's a lot, man.
I'm pretty sure I ran it through my simulator when I came up with that, I think. I think I was tweaking it after the fact, and I ran it through my simulator to dial it into the appropriate level. And I think that says that the challenge ratings that we generate for OD&D are, you know, in the ballpark. Nothing's perfect.
I mean, it still meant, I think, right? So I think I had a character who was really congratulating themselves at having at being AC1. And I'm like, I'm still only missing on a 5 or less.
Yes. Yes, sir.
No, or it's even better than that. Sorry, I'm missing on a 1 or a 2, right? Even a 3
you're right.
Plus 16 yep, plus right. AC1. Yeah. Yeah, even a 3 would hit. Yep. So I'm only missing on a 1 or a 2 on the AC1 guy.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Oof.
Oh, yeah.
They did get some lucky low damage rolls a couple of times. But yeah. Oh, I really brutalized them. This monster. And, yes, but it was a satisfying end, I think. It's a nice end to a convention game. You've got three players who are escaping with prisoners to say, yep, we did it. We made it out alive. We rescued some prisoners. And we can go back to the village and go, oh my God, there is something truly horrific. And yes, the nomads are coming for you. So time for plan B, villagers. Don't just keep sitting around farming, I guess, because you've got a lot of threats up the river.
You know, I got to admit, I don't mind, particularly for a convention game. You know, William at the top of the show was saying, oh, there's Lovecraftian vibes around here. And yes, we bring some Lovecraftian vibes into our games. And that's, you know, that's where D&D comes from, ultimately, I would argue. So I don't mind leaving the convention game as like there was like a dark, sinister thing that was beyond us at the end. Yeah. And that's not a bad memory to take away. Like maybe there'll be adventures in the future where you try to deal with that.
You know, the inverse would have been just as amazing if the last standing player managed to kill the extraplanar ooze and walked out of there and went, I lost two comrades, but I killed this horrific thing. And I prevented these nomads from berserking.
Yep. Right.
Great. Like how big of a win? That's huge. Right. I think that's very high energy ending there. Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
Last girl standing.
I want to talk about real quick here while we still have some time. I don't have it in front of me, so maybe you can put this up on screen. Hobo Ogre asked a great question here about the intelligent swords. Hobo Ogre asks, couldn't the sword lie to trick him into dying in a trap? And so I want to address this because I think it's an interesting call, and I'm curious how much of this is by the book versus how much is my interpretation. Here's the gist. I've got an intelligent sword that can talk, or, you know, I think it's through a telepathic link or something like that. I can't remember exactly how it works, but I always envision it as it's a, you know, it's in our brains, right? That nobody hears the sword talking except for the wielder. And the sword has some abilities. One of the abilities is detect traps. Now, definitely, I believe it's my interpretation that the way that works is not that just wielder grants the ability to detect traps, but rather that the sword can detect the traps and the wielder has to talk to the sword to make it happen. Because that's an amusing way for me to create interactions between the player and the sword. But I still assume that the sword is bound through whatever magic to like actually deliver the correct result. If the sword is just going to lie about the result of the power, why have the power at all? That almost feels like too rough to me, but I don't know. What are your thoughts, Dan?
I agree with you. And, you know, it's funny because when we drove away, I pulled out the book. I was talking to the folks that I was driving with and was, you know, marveling at the convoluted, the very intricate rules for intelligent swords that are in original D&D, and actually read them the rules. And there are, you know, intricate rules about who's in charge, right? So you have the sword's intelligence and ego, you have the player's level and strength and intelligence in different circumstances, and then you're supposed to compare, is the character currently wounded? And then their ability to be in charge of the sword instead of vice versa might go down as they get wounded. And so I think if they're on top of their game, there's very explicit rules there that the player is in charge, regardless of what the sword wants. And I think that, you know, maybe if the player gets, if the character gets damaged or weak, those numbers might tip in the other direction. And perhaps at that point, the sword suddenly becomes in charge, maybe if you follow the letter of the law there. But there are specific black letter law rules about one or the other is in charge. And I agree that the DM shouldn't just pitch it in the other direction because it's funny. I couldn't agree with how you're running it more.
No, I have on my blog, and we've mentioned this before, we have a whole episode about intelligent weapons where we discussed this in the past. But I have on my blog a couple posts about intelligent weapons and contested wills. And I have an alternative, a simplified method of doing the check, the contested will check, which is posted up there, which I recommend. It does include how wounded you are. In fact, I'd say, in my experience, that is the major game changer, right? For me, that is the most, when you look at the raw numbers, on these character sheets, generally my characters are going to always succeed the contested will check if they're healthy. Mm-hmm. And when they get down to below half hit points, that's when they're in trouble. That's when the sword is maybe going to take over. Now, I was definitely, like I said, I haven't run OD&D in quite a while. I was juggling a lot of different responsibilities as GM here. I 100% got to ever make any contested will checks during this game, which is too bad. But, you know, this particular sword, again, one of the things I like is I have these two different swords in play, and one of them is a coward and one of them is bloodthirsty, right? So if Aisha the Vexing did get control of this character, I would absolutely start making terrible decisions of rush into battle, ignore traps, run through. I think Aisha's excited as long as there's bloodshed. She does not care if it's the enemy or her wielder. As long as blood is being spilt, she's happy.
Great. Great. I love it. And I'll say that, you know, you and I both, and I had an intelligent sword in the D&D game that I was running that same afternoon, and you and I both wound up doing the same thing of, I had enough to do. I didn't engage with the ego contest rules. And it's interesting that we know now that looking at the pre-publication draft of original D&D 50 years ago, the whole intelligent sword section wasn't there. That was, you know, it's not really core to what D&D could have been, but it was created, you know, after the first draft by Dave Arneson and injected there. And it is this additional add-on system that's not, arguably isn't entirely necessary. And, you know, a lot of people play D&D without a lot of intelligent swords running around. So I do agree that the intricacy of those rules is sometimes, you know, is maybe wasn't the most play-tested thing in the entire game. And if we have to abbreviate those in game, I think you and I both find that's commonly necessary.
Yeah, it is making me realize, though, I think for future games, I need to make myself a checklist of don't forget to do these things, right? I would be interested in running a game where I'm using the Wandering Monster checks more in line with the way you do with a timer. And I would like to be on top of the events that cause. I probably need to write down for myself just a little cheat sheet of here's when to check for contested will and here's how. Right. I think I feel like I could use that like right in front of my face.
You know, let me talk a little bit my game, which gives a little bit of contrast, because so for what it's worth, just for a couple minutes. So that afternoon I was running a game of F. Chelric's Tomb, which is the very early adventure by Janelle J. Quaise. And I was running it because I like to test out these earliest adventures. And it was also a bit of an in memoriam for Janelle J. Quaise that passed away a couple months ago. And we had, you know, people in the game that were fans of Janelle's and fans of old school D&D, the way, you know, the way that I run. And of course, as we've said on a prior show, I'm pretty sure that was the first indie D&D publication, the first indie D&D adventure ever published in 1976, second after Arneson's Temple of the Frog. And I'll just say great design. If you can find a copy of F. Chelric's Tombs and run it, great design. Again, I would argue that it really set the tone for the way adventures were going to get written afterwards, of interesting detail, interesting stuff in every room. The players came away afterwards saying the whole thing was just like a really great puzzly dungeon, right? The whole thing just operated as a really great kind of single cohesive puzzle that we were trying to figure out. It fit really well in a 4-hour convention slot. We basically got to, I don't know, all of the areas except for one in the 4 hours. So it was timed well. I got playing it, and among the things that I discovered that I didn't think about on the fly is that, you know, like with our map that's on screen right now by Dyson Logos, right, we're used to our maps being 1 square per 10 feet. And Janelle made the map at 1 square per 5 feet. Which is actually what you would do nowadays if you're running a battle map or tactical stuff. And just like you, Paul, I didn't expect to do this, but again, one of the players had a battle map and they wanted a map. It's kind of intricate, like Janelle would make her dungeons. So the players wanted to map it out carefully, and they pulled out, actually two people started mapping, one on paper and one pulled out a wet erase battle map, started drawing it. And I said, well, let me just help you out. You're going to start over on this side. And as we discovered, the map perfectly fit on a modern battle map. And I mean, obviously that's surprising. To be a coincidence, right? But the map is at 1 inch per 5 feet. I could easily express it like I would tend to use the word pace for 5 feet. And it perfectly, exactly fit from one end to the other end of the modern battle map. Just perfectly. Mm. It's crazy magical coincidences. So really, you know, for 1976, like magically well designed for modern play in a lot of ways. The time is right. The extent is right. The detail is right. The scale is right. There's a lot of, it's a tomb and quite a bit of that dressing clearly inspired like Alan Lucian's Tomb of Rehotep that we've played on the stream before on a Halloween game, which itself heavily influenced Gygax's Tomb of Horrors. So those top canonical bits that we expect to see in D&D Dungeons arguably come really from Jay Quay's F. Chelric's tomb. And it was really fascinating to touch back on those kinds of tricks and puzzles, arguably from the first place that they popped up. But let me just talk about, it fit 4 hours pretty well. In the convention, like with the Wandering Monsters, I'm rolling Wandering Monsters. And whereas in a somewhat more relaxed campaign, I've got it on a 15-minute timer, I kind of hand-waved it away for the convention spot. I'm thinking, I'm tracking the pacing now a little bit better than I did in the past. I'm tracking the time. I want to make sure we get to the major beats. And I actually, for this, I hand-waved the 15-minute timer. And I was basically rolling Wandering Monsters when the player said, we're going to comprehensively search for secret doors in a space. And that gives them some risk reward. That gives them some, and if one player had an intelligent sword that could detect evil within about 10 feet, and they were like, well, I want to go down this passageway very carefully and detect evil in every space. I go, okay, you can do that, but you're going to have more wandering monster checks. And we did that once. And then they readjusted what their protocol was going to be. And they were trying to gauge a little bit better about whether they could detect guess whether there was going to be specific risks coming up. And like I say, someone had to descend a shaft to check out a room below. There's a wandering monster check there. When they bring the rest of the party down, I check halfway through when they're split up and kind of in a possibly vulnerable situation. And ultimately, over the four-hour session, there weren't any wandering monsters. I never rolled a one. I brought out the big D6, and everybody was a little tense, and it made for a dramatic moment. Yep. I'd roll the D6 in the open. I was never going to fake the encounter roll. So it's in public. If a one had shown up, I would have brought out wandering monsters right out of the core book. It happened and never happened in this game, and I was happy about that. We had enough to do. There was enough content for the 4 hours. And ultimately, as DM, I was actually happy we didn't have any wandering monsters because we had other stuff to do. And that's the way that just happened to work out. And I was happy the pacing worked for us.
The wandering monster thing, I think it bleeds into, like, I think we agree that, like, the only real difference here, frankly, it sounds like, is not the timer. I mean, the timer is an interesting idea, but the real thing here is that we kind of agree that there should have been a wandering monster check at the point where they're trying to cross this water. And the only real difference is that I kind of decided I'm not going to roll because I think it's just going to be more fun if there is one. And I will stand by that every day of like, if you feel strongly that this outcome is going to lead to more fun, then maybe ask if you really should be rolling. Right. Like, and I do this in the inverse as well. Like, I do this a lot in my horror games when players are making skill checks where they're like, oh, I'm going to try XYZ. And I go, okay, well, I can imagine how you would do a skill check to accomplish that. But it just makes sense for the story that you do that thing. And it doesn't sound like a terribly difficult thing. So why do I want to risk you rolling dice and coming up a failure and me having to reinterpret a whole bunch of stuff? Let's just say you don't have to roll. It's fine. It just happens. And so I do that pretty frequently.
Yeah, you know, I forgive you, Paul.
Thanks, appreciate it.
But you know, but It's you know, in some places it's a good idea. And like, just as a very quick example, if someone's searching, like doing a search for a secret door or something like that, and I know there's nothing there, and I tend to frequently say, you are very confident there's nothing here. You've checked the door carefully, and you're very confident there's no traps on this door, and you can go through it whenever you want to. So, you know, trying to abbreviate things for the pacing is among the most important things, of course.
Yeah. And doubly so, I think, when you're in a time limited one shot, right? Whether that's a convention or otherwise, you're like looking at the clock going, I mean, let me get the most fun out of every minute that we have together here, because we're going to go our separate ways after this. So yeah, I'm all for that.
Yes.
And we are totally out of time. Completely out of time. Any final thoughts on HelgaCon or our WDM01 Asymmetric Monastery of the Deranged Berserker, available now on DriveThruRPG?
I love these kind of con games. They're a great opportunity to meet new players, to test your creations, to test your dungeons, possibly a new system with new players, people that are going to have a fresh take on it, to iron out some things, to discover some things about your encounters or adventures or systems that you hadn't seen until you get a fresh pair of eyes on it. So I certainly come away with a lot of improvements that I can make either for adventures or encounters or just the way that I run games, as a matter of fact. I would recommend, keep good notes. Keep good notes about the timing, right? The pacing is really critically important, or the rulings or the questions that you didn't expect in advance. And I was taking the opportunity this morning to go through my notes for my sessions and, not forget and, hopefully document maybe possibly a house rule or a margin rule or something like that. Or maybe edit, right? Maybe edit something out of an adventure to make it fit the convention time better. And I'm certainly getting better at the pacing and getting the timing right than I was even just a couple of years ago. So those kinds of opportunities are really invaluable to make things better. And I bet that our dungeon design dashes in the future, Paul, will only improve from, being able to see how well they fit in a standard slot like that.
Yeah. I'd like to get back to those. The first three have been published. The fourth one is still in the edit phase. We're going to try and get that out soon. And then I'd love to be doing more of these down the road. It is just super fun for me. I hope the viewers like it, but who cares? It's fun for me, Dan. I like doing it.
See, this is where I embrace 100%. Thank you for that.
I'm just going to put it up on screen one more time. Viewers, if you're looking for this, hopefully there's a link here in the YouTube description to this on DriveThruRPG. If not, we were very clever here at numbering these. We called it WDM01. If you just enter WDM01 in your DriveThruRPG search field, this thing comes right up. So here you can see it. And most importantly, I think that we definitely proved the one question I had, which is, would this make a good one-shot or a convention game? And the answer is decidedly yes. So if you're looking for a one-shot, go grab this one. It's a great one. And then hopefully we'll see some more in the future. If viewers, if you've run this thing and would like to tell us how it went for you, I would so love to hear that. Please, please, please leave us a comment here in the YouTube video for us to see, or get in touch with us through any of our other channels. Mention us on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. Tell us about your experience running WDM01, Asymmetric Monastery of the Deranged Berserkers. I would love to hear how it went for you.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, and TikTok. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites. So please, go berserk on that like button!
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio only podcast format, maybe when you're on your commute or doing house chores, you can absolutely do that. Those audio podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. And they're also through various podcast carriers. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Twitter, but that's not what I'm trying to say. You can find us on iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and Pocket Cast and Podcast Addict. And a whole bunch of other ones. And if we're not on your favorite podcast carrier, let us know and I'll fix that. But if you are listening to the show right now on one of those other podcast websites and you like our show, please, and if they give the ability to do it, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll see our different tiers, including our $1 tier. Every single tier gets you access to our Discord server, where the conversation with our wonderful patrons is happening all the time about horror games and fantasy games and miniatures and all kinds of stuff like that. Number of times in the last week, we've had DMs pop in and say, I have a problem at my game table. What can we do to resolve this? And we've just had such great suggestions and solutions to improve everybody's game communally. We just have the best patrons. We would love for you to join us if you're not there already. And of course, we'll also be there on our video after chat, like Paul talked about at the top of the show. And if you're new there, please jump in, and we would love to have the conversation continue in the next hour with your observations about personal games or our dungeon design dashes. And we are looking forward to your insights. You know, I'm gonna give a shout out to Craig Worrell, who jumped in the chat right at the end of the show here, and great memories about our friend BJ, who was the number three for our team in the past, and we miss him every year at our house con, and we think about him all the year. So thanks for the reminder about that, Craig, and thanks for being here. Paul, we're both going to be on the after chat in about 10 minutes, yes?
Yep, absolutely.
Great. And don't forget, I've got Dan's Old Time Mini Show, and I'll be back on Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and I'll be trying to make a mold for the multi-part insectoid Vrusk from the Star Frontiers game. And that's going to be definitely the most complicated miniature that I've tried to make a mold for to date. So we'll see if I get anywhere near success to that. But I'm looking forward to trying. So that's happening Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And then Paul and I, of course, will be back next week because we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.